Group meeting, Friday, 22nd June, 1984. We all know what is happening in the world today, and it is impossible to avoid taking account of the fact that there is a possibility that we are really moving towards catastrophe, from which there might be no return. Now, people in the world will say that it may be due to the misuse of nuclear energy. That, of course, is a possibility. They will also find all sorts of other reasons, such as the expanding world population. And there seems to be no stopping of this expansion. In spite of movements, worldwide movements, like the International Planned Parenthood Federation, which is working very hard and up to a point succeeding in keeping numbers down, persuading people to have, say, not more than two or three children at most. In spite of work like that, the fact remains that the world population is just expanding in the most appalling way. China, of course, as you know, is well over 1,000 million. India is 730 million now. It was 250 million when I first came to England. Something like that. Or maybe a little more. So that may be another reason. Then again, there is the pollution of the atmosphere taking place. To such an extent that all life is endangered by it. Plant life, to start with, life in the oceans, and of course also on the land. It is practically impossible to wake people up to a sense of what is happening. Now, whilst all these material reasons hold good up to a point, showing that we seem to be moving towards catastrophe from which there'll be no return, the most important reason is something which only a few people really see. They may see it intellectually and agree with the idea, as they call it. They don't see it as the fundamental fact. All these external things in the world, the material reasons for this continual degeneration, the real source is the individual. Who is responsible for this appalling growth in population? We are well over 4,000 million now. And they say that by the end of the century, we may well be 6,000 millions. Who is responsible for this increase in population but ourselves, human beings? Who is responsible for pollution? Human beings again, fundamentally. With all our factories and whatnot, belching poisonous things into the air, and then of course particularly the oxides of sulfur and nitrogen dissolve in the moisture in the atmosphere, which of course is due to the natural process of the heat of the sun evaporating the water of the oceans and so on. And those oxides dissolve easily in water and fall back upon us as acid rain. I wonder how many of us have sort of indulged in chemistry. Now, chemistry has been my principal subject from my school days and in, of course, Cambridge. And I have taught chemistry in schools and so forth. And I know to a considerable degree exactly how serious this is. If you have actually dealt with acids, and of course also alkalis, and particularly with organic chemicals, you will see how very terrible are the effects of these chemicals, not merely upon the human body as such, but upon life in general. So, with our passion for motor cars and whatnot, and greater speeds, and the petrol fumes, it's the petrol fumes which are the real source of the trouble, we are slowly making for the conditions, ensuring the conditions, which will wipe us out. And then, on top of it all, this extraordinary greed, which has absolutely enslaved most of the human race. I say most only, not the whole of the human race. There are people who still live simply and are content to live simply and live humanly. But most people want more and more and more all the time. So this economic problem will simply become impossible to solve. It seems to me, and of course I am just an ignorant layman in these matters, it seems to me that this economic problem will be impossible to solve according to the ideas of politicians and economists and so forth. The root of all economic difficulties is simply myself who wants more and more. And it is quite unnecessary, really, all this wanting more. Fundamental needs, food, warmth, shelter, education, health, if we confine ourselves to those fundamental needs. Fundamental needs can easily be supplied even to 4,000 million people. If the supply is not spoiled by individual greeds of thousands of millions, literally thousands of millions, who just want more and more. And then if they do not get what they want, they are at war with the state. Not only the government part of the state, but with the rest of the people in the state. We all suffer as the result of these strikes and so forth. country. Especially, for example, supposing water supply, electricity, gas were all cut off, transport, postal services, no letters, and so forth. What would happen to the world? People rebelled to a sufficient extent, it would just shut everything down unnecessarily. There is, of course, another need too, and then namely our cultural needs. And here the question of education comes in, and the responsibility of teachers to continue their work. And teachers say that the salaries they get are quite insufficient to keep up with everything. What are they keeping up with? It really is unnecessary, all this keeping up. I'm an old age pensioner, and we manage very nicely upon just that and just a little more, which comes through the generosity of group members, partly, for which we are extremely grateful. In fact, without them, we wouldn't be able to start to eat. But because everything else, the impossible to avoid payments, are so terrible. Well now, but we manage nicely. You look at me, I'm still alive and well and decently dressed. And so is Sylvia. And the house is not too bad. It's no more decrepit than I am at the moment. So if we can manage like this, why on earth can't all these thousands of millions of people in the world manage? It's all humbug. It's just this passion to possess. They are the slaves of this utterly idiotic idea, a lunatic idea, that possession buys happiness, power, fulfillment, and all the rest of it. It does the very reverse. Excessive possession. Fundamental needs, of course, have to be satisfied. And cultural needs, it is good to be able to satisfy them because it makes life really better in quality. Where would we be today, for instance, in the Western world, without our music, poetry, architecture, painting, and so on? Where would we be? Just nowhere. However, we must consider this matter of the fundamental cause, and that lies within me, myself. It is my greed, my fear, my anxiety, my stupidity, my violence, my illusions and delusions, which are the most powerful influences for the world's disease. Now, if we can really see that, it's easy to hear somebody speak, somebody whom you trust, whom you believe in. It's easy to read about it in books and or hear lectures and so forth. And say, oh yes, yes, that's quite true, isn't it? And having said that, and both parties having nodded approval to each other and with each other, you see, then that's the end of it. They don't really see. And what do I mean by really see? You don't see with your brain. What you do see with your brain is just what comes to the brain through the sense avenues, sight, sounds, tastes, touches, and what comes up as a result of memory and the inward ceaseless churning up of thought, and which is only inaudible chatter, that's all. And it all revolves round I. I like this, I want that, I want to go there, I should like this, and so forth and so forth. You know, it's astonishing. I catch myself after, what, over 50 years of religious practice, I catch myself doing just that sort of thing. So what would younger people be like? So now, to see in the full sense means to be truly conscious. If I'm truly conscious that it is my greed and violence and stupidity and so forth which is responsible for what goes wrong in the world, if I'm really conscious of it, then that vision, that tremendous understanding means such wisdom, such compassion, that this person ceases, just naturally ceases, to be greedy, to be violent, to be stupid. Now this is the meaning of really seeing the fact. It is not just an intellectual understanding, not it just a turmoil in the brain which will produce arguments and reasons and a thought structure. A thought structure doesn't do much. It does a certain amount. It does a great deal where mechanical things are concerned. It is indispensable in the mechanical aspect of life. But where life, real living human life, in the human way is concerned, it is almost an obstruction. For the very simple reason that we have used this brain intellectuality throughout our lives as slaves of our desires. We have never challenged our desires. That is why knowledge is a nuisance. In fact, nowadays it has become a curse. Look at the fear we have over the misuse of nuclear energy. We have the knowledge of what we can do with nuclear energy, and we haven't got the intelligence, the wisdom, the compassion which will save us from misusing nuclear energy. See? That is what it is. So now, in order to see like that, in order to persuade our intellects not to be the slaves of our lower desires, our greeds and passions and all the rest of it, in order to do that, we have to understand that this is where religion comes in. Religion is that which teaches us what we actually are. When I say religion, I don't mean the doctrines and dogmas and all the rest of that heap of rubbish. There's a great heap of rubbish in all the religions of the world. I don't mean that. But I mean the not only the feeling, but the inner knowledge that religion is that way of life which restores us to union with the source from which everything comes. That is religion. If we see it that way, we will begin to understand, only begin to understand, the real meaning of goodness. We say these words, truth, compassion, wisdom, goodness, beauty, and all the rest of it. It's easy to say those words, but our brain will define the words somewhat like a dictionary gives you a definition. But a dictionary definition and what the brain sees as such is impotent. It is not creative. It is just impotent. The proof of this impotence is look at the world. Just see what the state of the world is. We have become very proud of all our improvements and so forth. Unquestionably there are improvements, and all honor to the people who have been mainly responsible for bringing about those improvements. I'm not suggesting for a moment that we should cast them aside, but there are much more important things which we have to attend to, namely ourself, our nature. What is a human being? The word human means happy creator, the blissful creator, I would say. That is what the word human means. The prefix hu, H-U, in Pali it is S-U, in Sanskrit it is H-U, and in Avastan it is H. H is, they have H instead of S. So, su means well done, that which has come to a happy conclusion, and so forth. And the man part, M-A-N, from which man, mind, and so forth are derived. The Sanskrit root man, the dictionary will give you a potty little definition that it means to think. It doesn't mean to think in the way in which we think. How do I think? I just chatter in my brain. That is not thinking. We use the term thought power. We use a phrase like mind over matter, but we haven't got the slightest shadow of a ghost of a conception of what this thought power means. Man is that archetypal form of the creative energy which invariably, inevitably, naturally and spontaneously brings forth the universe. And it brings forth a universe in which is embodied order. I know that astrophysicists will tell us that the universe, all the galaxies are in a state of terrific disorder, very much like school children at break time. You know, they run out in the field and in the playground and make a tremendous noise, and they are knocking each other about and playing games and falling down and jumping up, and all sorts of disorder prevails there, you see. But that is not the state of the universe as such. Everything that has been created out of that primordial creative energy has this absolute divine order implicit in it. Whether it be a single atom or a microbe or a virus, or whether it be a whole world, a planet, whether it be a holy one or a genius or whoever it is. Everything has this inherent. But we are blind to it. We are not conscious of it. I can talk like this, but am I really conscious of that tremendous power? And that is the root meaning of the word man. So the human, and that is that has created the universe. We say God created the universe. In the Bible you have, and God said, let this, that, and the other. He said, fortunately, just a few things, and they all came into being at once. Can you and I do that? If we say it, but if we think it, the thought in the mind of God is the creative power. God is not a person, not an entity. There is no such thing as an entity God. It is impossible to have an entity God. I'll tell you why. The word entity stands for something separate, something which therefore has come into being, something which is observable, something which therefore has come into being. But whatsoever comes into being has its span, and then it dies, it disintegrates. There is nothing in the manifested universe which doesn't come to death. You see? Now, the religions, particularly the theistic religions, have made a marvelous blunder for the last 4,000 or 5,000 years. They say God is the holy other, the eternal, the infinite, the immortal, which is all absolute rubbish. Because if God, the word God is intended to represent the immortal, the eternal, and the infinite, then they mustn't talk of God as an entity, as a being. That is entirely wrong. That which is infinite, eternal, and immortal is not an entity. It is the unknown. It is by me, by ordinary human beings, the unknowable. But it is the experienceable. You see? And when once you have experienced the reality of that transcendence, then you are entitled to affirm that transcendence is. Or if you like to use the word God, God is. Or say Brahman is, or whatever you like. You see, the word doesn't matter. It is the conception attached to the word. The silly little conceptions out of innumerable half-witted brains throughout the world. I'm talking very violently, am I not? but just try and feel it. Don't believe a word of what I say. Don't believe it. Your belief is impotent. If what I say happens to represent truth, even in a small degree, if you can really become conscious of that truth, your whole life will be absolutely transformed. Because consciousness, this innermost consciousness, is the source of all energy in your existential being. All your thinking, feeling, speaking, doing is the expression of that innermost consciousness. That innermost consciousness is something which I don't know. It lies hidden. It is, as some religions have put it, the spark of the divine in you. But I say it is that in you there is no spark of the divine. The whole of the divine is embodied in you. I know that nobody else has said this, and people might say, what on earth is this fellow talking about? I'm telling you something which is really true. The totality of the creative energy, the totality of infinity, eternity, immortality is all in you, in every bit of you. But evolution, the universal process, is of such a nature that that in the manifestation, in material form and shape and so on, that divinity has become imprisoned. And the poor little brain by itself cannot get hold of it. Let me read to you something from one of the Upanishads, by the way. This comes from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is the greatest of the Upanishads as such. It is, the heading here is Renunciation, the way to know Brahman. It doesn't tell you what you renounce, but that we know we have to renounce our greed, our violence, our absurdities, our illusions, our passionate attempt all the time to grasp something for ourselves. That's what we've got to renounce. Now, two sages are talking. One of them, Yajnavalkya, is one of the greatest of the Upanishadic teachers that ever lived. And the other person who is speaking to him, his name is Kahola Kaushitekaya. Yajnavalkya, said he, explain to me Brahman that is immediately present and directly perceived, that is the Self in all things. Yajnavalkya answers, this Brahman is yourself in all things. It is that which transcends hunger and thirst, sorrow and delusion, old age and death. Brahmans, having known that Self, having overcome the desire for sons, the desire for wealth, the desire for worlds, live the life of mendicants. Now, the desire for sons, you see, in those, remember, this goes back something like 3,000 years at least, if not about 3,500 years. You see, this sort of teaching. Sons meant perpetuity, it meant economic stability, and all the ordinary necessities of life. That's why they talk of sons. The desire, and sons, of course, was their wealth. The desire for worlds. People may say, well, how can you desire a world? The word worlds in the Upanishads has to be understood as different states of consciousness, which you enter upon in meditation. Who live the life of mendicants. That which is the desire for sons is the desire for wealth. The desire for wealth is the desire for the worlds, for both these are but desires. Therefore, now this is the important thing, let a Brahman, after he has done with learning, desire to live as a child of these is the kingdom of heaven. When he has done both with the state of childhood and with learning, then he becomes a silent meditator, which means that he does not write mighty essays in imagination. sitting cross-legged and silent and doing nothing to earn a decent living. It doesn't mean that. A silent meditator. Your meditator is one who can enter, consciously enter, the transcendent states. Then you are silent. Unlike me, who am chattering all the time. When he has done both with the state of childhood and with learning, he becomes a silent meditator. Having done with both the non-meditative and the meditative states, then he becomes a knower of Brahman. Now, the word know mustn't be understood in our ordinary everyday meaning. You know this, you know the other, you know how to cook, you know how to do your job and all the rest of it. It is not that. To know in the religious sense, in the transcendent sense, is to be that which you know in consciousness. You see, the practice of meditation has as one of its elements to concentrate your attention. If, for example, you concentrate your attention upon, say, a tree or whatever you choose to concentrate upon, there comes the point when all turmoil in the brain, the incessant chatter which will go on when you start meditating, that will gradually come down and finally absolutely stop, like a stream in the desert. Because all our chatter is just streams in the desert. That will stop. And when that stops, you will be completely awake in that transcendent silence, which is the Absolute. So now you see, this is the fulfillment of a human being, the happy creator. Now, we have talked a good bit in the past about the art of meditating and so forth. So I won't say anything at the moment. But the art of meditating is not something which is exclusive to time, place, and posture. Meditation can go on continuously. It must go on continuously. There are two fundamental aspects to it. One is that the senses are so trained, and you have such command over your senses, that whatsoever impressions come to you do not get a riposte, a throwback out of your brain. Say you see a rotten apple and you say, oh, that rotten apple. No, nothing of the sort. You are seeing a rotten apple. That is all. When you come to the stage where that is all, you are no longer violent, you are no longer uncompassionate. You are no longer merely knowing. You are at one with it. In inner consciousness. In real union with it. And that is the aspect as far as the external world is concerned. And then inwardly, I don't know quite how to put it, but I'll try. inwardly experiencing being that which you are observing produces a state where you are utterly harmless to the world in which you live. The supreme harmlessness takes place. This is what the religions called the love of God for His creation. This harmlessness. But the love of God does not make Him interfere with the hate and stupidity of man in the world or of anything. I wonder how many of you have read Deuteronomy carefully. Read the last few chapters of Deuteronomy very carefully. You'll find extraordinary things said by the Lord God to Moses, which Moses tells the Israelites. I have set before you life and death. I have set before you good and evil. Choose the good that life may come to fulfillment. That is the gist of the meaning. But he says distinctly, I have set both before you. And in chapter 32, verse 39, he says, the Lord God says, see now that I, even I, am He, meaning the Lord God, and there is no God, no other God, therefore, with me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal. Neither is there any that can deliver out of my hand. You know, this sort of thing is not properly appreciated, understood, or dealt with. So, when this inner awakening takes place, you will find yourself in complete unity with all that happens, the good and the bad, the pleasant and the horrible, and everything. And in that state, you yourself are utterly harmless. You see, you take no sides whatsoever, but you see what is wrong, what is evil, and you yourself, because of your compassion, your consciousness heals that which is wrong. Now, if we can sort of begin to do something along these lines in our own daily lives, we shall send out energies for the healing of the world, which the world will never know or understand, but it will find itself getting healed.